Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Eric, let's do a top 15 list of the biggest news stories coming out of tonight's show. Starting with 15. What's 15?
Jake Hager likes his hat.
I think that's number three, sadly. What do you think of the show? Because this was not the most newsworthy show. It felt like back-to-back rampages, perhaps a special Wednesday night two-hour rampage. And that's not, you know, inherently a bad thing, except for, you know, people who do podcasts and talk about controversies and big promos and angles.
I think that is the most Minnesota passive-aggressive thing I've ever heard out of your mouth, and that's covering a lot of ground, sir. A back-to-back rampage? That's quite an insult.
I enjoy Rampage. It's a nice, you know, hour of AEW wrestling, but not usually a lot of angles.
I mean, Wade, I'm higher on AEW generally than you are, and even I can't say I'm a huge fan of Rampage.
Well, I mean, it has its ups and downs, but there's some good wrestling on there. Well, am I being unfair to tonight's Dynamite? But I mean, well, obviously, I like Rampage better than you, maybe. Nevertheless, this was kind of a double Rampage, a 2-hour Rampage, right?
I disagree. Danielson and Bandido was a great match. Went in my notebook for match of the year. If there were higher stakes in it and more personal feud, probably would have even been better. You had the next, they furthered angles tonight. I think it's fair to call it, you know, like a maintenance show, you know, like when you're watching Prestige TV and they kind of move the chess pieces in place, as opposed to Tony Soprano choking out Christopher Moltisanti. Sorry, spoiler alert. At the end of the,
I'm going to watch that series one of these months.
The Sopranos.
Yeah. But I'll forget everything that anyone said about it other than the ending. I mean, you not have that spoiled.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I know, I thought, in the opening segment, which I hated, you furthered, the best friends and Team Jeff Jarrett storyline. Top Flight and the Young Bucks set up a future six-man tag team title match. Hangman Page was, vague as hell about where he's headed next.
That's the headline, is Hangman Page wants to reconcile with CM Punk, planting the seeds for the reconciliation.
Well, that's not on my list. The Elite or the Dark Order were my leading two. You know, you furthered Starks and Action Andretti versus Jericho Appreciation Society. Danielson continued his journey. You had a heel turn with the AEW Outsiders women. And then you had a main event that was rampagey feeling, to your point, I guess. I mean, an open challenge. Nobody thought Kushida was going to win, but he took most of the match, as one does, against Darby Allin. So, yeah, you know, one of the things about AEW and its booking pacing is – there are so many weeks between the last pay-per-view of the year and the first pay-per-view of the following year. There are still 7 more Dynamites to go before Revolution. So some of the feuds for Revolution are already penciled in, Danielson, MJF at the top, but man, Starks and JAS could be wrapped up by then. You know, it sounded tonight like a Hangman Page and Moxley might be wrapped up. I mean, I don't think I heard.
I'm fine with that.
Page that indicated there was going to be a rubber match, at least not until way down the road when they come back to it months or years later. And so, you know, you will get shows like this where they give you good action, they further some storylines, but they don't, it's not really building to a pay-per-view match. And that's kind of what tonight was.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of like B-level storyline progression and C-level storyline progression, but it wasn't a magical follow-up to Adam Cole's return last week. You know, we got a video package at least on it. But you know, in terms of like B-level happenings, I mean, in kind of joking aside, I guess the Young Bucks jobbing to Top Flight is a notable deal. I hope that's more than like some sort of meta message. Hey, look, we're putting over, we're elevating younger guys. And I hope it's like actually leading to something storyline wise with one or both teams. What is your take on that? Were you surprised? And what do you expect the follow-up to be?
I was not surprised. I mean, I was surprised in that I looked it up on Cage Match today. The Young Bucks had won their previous two meetings. I thought, just based on past actions, that Top Flight would be in for a push when Darius got back, and then he got injured again, and now he's back again. And that seems to be how they've been building Top Flight. They've been getting wins on the YouTube shows. And the Young Bucks were coming off of a really grueling best of seven series, and so they had a built-in excuse to lose, kind of a New Japan style excuse to lose. Like when you come back from injury in New Japan, you tend to lose your first match. And so it made logical sense. One of my pre-show notes was, you know, there's no setup for this match, but it could set up a six-man title challenge. And I think that's probably what they did tonight. Did they do a Top Flight interview afterward? I don't think they did. I guess they could do that next week, and you might want to pre-tape that anyway, given their lack of experience on the mic. But, yeah, I mean, I think they set up the next six-man title challengers for the Elite. So I think that was mission accomplished.
Yeah, yep. Very good. Well, let's pause early here and introduce ourselves in the show and then get to some calls and emails and other discussion on the program. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of a bunch of pro wrestling podcasts, including this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Shows, following Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, and also the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, our blue logo, which tomorrow will feature Todd Martin, PW Torch VIP analyst, who will be talking at length about the death of Jay Briscoe, which AEW acknowledged at the beginning of the show tonight. Just a really sad story, obviously, goes without say, and the number of wrestlers who you've probably seen on Twitter or quoted in various website stories matches what wrestlers who knew them are telling me privately. And that is just how much they liked them as people. It's just that they were just described as good guys to be around and very giving and just like, you know, not necessarily matching the whole range of their personas when it comes to their behind the scenes activity. So we'll have a big section on tomorrow's flagship on that sad news. Check out pwtorch.com for the latest developments as we find out some more details on that head-on crash that ended Jay Briscoe's life. But on that somber note, shifting over to introducing my co-host, Eric Kroll. Eric, I want to thank you for delaying your appearance on Slap Fight tonight in order to co-host. I hope you aren't it's not held against you that you wanted to save yourself for next week.
You know, I got to say, podcast is a challenge primarily because of the reason you mentioned, Jay Briscoe. Secondarily, because of Nick Khan's vile interview with Bill Simmons today, where he tried to clean up Vince McMahon's scandals and dismiss them. Thirdly, because podcasting while Slap Fight is going on, and I have to talk to you for a couple hours instead of watching. Oh wait, no, thank you, Wade, for helping me avoid watching Slap Fight.
Mike McMahon on Twitter said, "I'm sorry. I like combat sports." This is PW Torch Daily Cast host Mike McMahon, co-host on the show sometimes. But this power slap thing looks like the absolute dumbest thing on the planet. Where's the art and skill in just slapping a stationary human as hard as you can until you knock them out? I can't believe how dumb and boring this looks. He's got a whole thread on there, so you can go follow at Torch McMahon to see if this show can change his mind, I guess I should say. Eric, any thoughts?
I was waiting to see, you know, what the intro would be, and it was like your obligatory shot of like a skyline, and then the first shot after that was a picture of Dana White at like a judge's table. Oh, that guy. Who wants to see that guy who caught on video slapping his wife? Now he's on TV, on national cable television, promoting a show called Slap Fight, only in America, folks.
Yes, yes. Well, Eric Kroll, you have an article up on pwtorch.com in the editorial section on AEW. Tell people about that. You by the way, you've been writing for The Torch with about a 28-year gap in the middle since 1990. You were a Pro Wrestling Torch columnist way back when we were college students. Now you're contributing again, both in podcasts and some guest articles here. Sell people on this article. Tell people what it's about.
Well, it's, I think there's our free and VIP editions, and it's about AEW's, year of high drama, 2022, kind of recaps month by month, all the various dramatic episodes AEW and Tony Khan had to deal with. And, to try and shed a little context on how you're lucky as wrestling fans, you got as good of a year out of AEW as you did, and they drew a bunch of million-dollar houses, put on a bunch of great pay-per-views. When all of this drama is going on backstage, and when you stack it, the point of it was to stack it all up, to put it in one place and say, well, some of this was self-inflicted. A lot of it was was maybe you could have had better management, and some of it was beyond Tony Khan's control, to just kind of put it all in one place and provide some context. If you don't like AEW, well, one, you're probably not listening to this post show, but if you don't, you probably will think it's a bunch of excuses for Tony Khan, but really, it's just trying to add context and take a step back that's not always done in our daily, weekly, hot take world.
We used to. It was so nice when there was time for that, Eric.
The darn internet.
Yes, it's crazy. I kind of miss that, but you know what can you do? We live in exciting times. Well, I appreciate you being on the show, and you said this would be, you prepped me. You said, you know, I invited you on for, you know, what you call it, not a maintenance week, an off week, a down week after some red hot shows. Did it live down to your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the card and I thought, well, there's be some good action. Most of the action was good. The only match that exceeded expectations for me was Danielson Bandito. Everything else was or maybe slightly below expectations. Yeah, I mean, it's they all can't be pay-per-view quality shows like last week from Los Angeles. So you're going to get that. I did a little bit of research for this show, and they had a hot streak of 6 Dynamites in a row that had good matches and logic and good storylines advanced. Started when they went down to Texas on December 7th and continued through LA. You were going to get a good but not great Dynamite at some point, and I think that's what we got tonight. You got to breathe every now and again. You risk hot-shotting or giving away all your free matches, and we know if there's one thing Tony Khan has traditionally not liked to do, it's give away a bunch of matches in his holster.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at that two different ways, because like with Bryan Danielson, you get a lot of good matches, but there's the ones that seem like they might be a pay-per-view main event or co-main event someday, and those he just holds off on until he can feature them on the main event or until someone gets hurt or leaves the company, and then you don't get to see it. So, yeah, it's a real variety.
See Cody and possibly CM Punk.
Yeah, yep. And I think you can make the case for others, too, where, you know, with hindsight, you look back and go, oh, I should have pulled the trigger sooner on that. Well, I want to give out the phone number and email if you are listening to us tonight and live. And if you're live streaming us and you want to call in, you are invited. The number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That flags you on our switchboard. We'd love to hear from you. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That's wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, let's actually do this in reverse at the beginning here, because I want to take a couple emails, and I want to begin with Zach in Texas, who we often go to last, and we'll go to him first. Gentlemen, well, it's another great night of in-ring action from AEW. Danielson and Bandido tore the house down. That was an excellent match. MJF's promo afterwards was great, too. He's been sitting under the Jake Roberts learning tree, because that was a Jake the Snake promo. Low, slow, quiet, and menacing. Darby and Kushida didn't disappoint either. My biggest takeaway, though, was that the Tony Storm-Saraya heel turn is just what the doctor ordered. Saraya never settled into being a face, and I think she can thrive as an arrogant heel. The Outsiders versus AW original storyline could be really good. I'm already interested in seeing if Tony and Saraya pull Ruby to their side. I'm also interested to see if people clutch their pearls at the sight of a 10-woman war inside a steel cage. There's really only one way to close this email. Reach for the sky, boys. R.I.P. Jay Briscoe. So I start with this because it hit a couple items, Eric, that we haven't hit yet, including what might be the top story of the show, and that is the angle with Saraya and Tony Storm. If you consider that an official heel turn or leaning heel or one of those things where, oh, you pick them, you just decide who you like. Excalibur on commentary kind of set the table that Saraya and Tony Storm are kind of looking at themselves or looking around the locker room at the AEW originals and wanting to kind of stake out their ground, their territory. When Ruby came out at the end, I don't know if they intentionally did it or not, but it seemed like that might have been a moment where she was going to turn also as somebody who came over from WWE. They didn't do that. She stayed with Willow. Your thoughts overall on that angle, and do you like the idea of an Outsiders versus AW original storyline, and does Ruby Soho fit, or do you expect her to turn if that is the direction they continue to go?
I think it was pretty clearly a heel turn. They did the distraction roll-up finish with the tights for the win, and then for no reason at all, poor, popular, bubbly, loved-by-the-fans Willow Nightingale gets stomped for no reason, right? I don't know that she did anything to deserve that. So that would certainly be the hallmarks of a traditional heel turn. I felt it was a bit rushed. I mean, we went from week one, a kind of Mean Girls pre-taped promo where Saraya picked Tony Storm over Hikaru Shida and was rude about it, and Shida was left shaking her head. And then Shida screwed up the last week two in L.A. Shida screws up the kendo stick in the ring, and the heels get it, or well, Britt and Jamie Hayter get it and score the win over them. And then this week there is another rude backstage promo where they're leaning into their heelish personas, Saraya and Tony, and then right away the next segment they're out in the ring and they do the heel turn. So it feels a bit rushed, but I don't know. Sometimes 3 weeks to build a story is a lot for AEW standards. So maybe I'm being too much of a traditionalist. A couple thoughts occurred to me that the Ruby Soho thought that you had occurred to me as well. Ruby and Willow Nightingale have were like an odd couple tag team where Ruby just, you know, a cynical goth woman was always rolling her eyes and shaking her head at Willow's bubbly persona. You would think they were bonded in blood on Rampage with the tag match they had against the Jericho Appreciation Society team. So that did occur to me. Boy, it would have been terrible if they pulled the trigger on that tonight too, like a double turn, right? Mm-hmm. Set everything up. It also occurred to me, so I'm thinking, so is this a double turn? Are Britt and Jamie Hayter going to be faces? Because if you leave those two on the heel side, you got a really unbalanced women's roster. And then it occurred to me, Thunder Rosa hasn't been around. She would be considered an AEW original. What if this is all a build-up, to have a big Thunder Rosa comeback, end of this month or maybe early February? And then you've got Rosa, Willow, Nightingale. But that's where it kind of falls apart. Who else would be on the babyface side who could get a
Nyla Rose?
I think she and Marina Shafir have been teasing dissension on the YouTube shows, so that's possible. She's an AEW original. Chris Statlander has been out a really long time with a knee injury. She would be another AEW original, but that you tie all those top babyface women up, then who's challenging heel Jamie Hayter for the at the next pay-per-view? I don't know. I guess we'll let it play out, but if this is a setup for a big Thunder Rosa return, I would think that would help Thunder Rosa get over if those two were heels. I guess the other observation I would make, is, boy, man, and I want to get your thoughts on this, Saraya just with her tone-deaf, tin-eared comment after comment, promo after promo, when she came in with this, I mean, that Saraya being a baby face who's coming back after that many years away and injured, and she just comes in like she owns the place and says all this crappy stuff. She almost booked herself into a corner, and they had no choice but to turn her heel. And now Toni Storm is going to go along for the ride because her babyface run kind of was over after Hayter beat her for the title.
So your question is, did she basically unintentionally set up an inevitable heel turn because of her tone deafness?
Yeah.
Yes, the answer is yes. I mean, I don't think it was a master plan, but I think they just, you know, looked at her and her approach and the way she talked and how fans, you know, they cheered her because she's a star and they have this, you know, history with her. But it didn't take off in part because she was in some bad segments and clunky matches, but it also didn't take off because she came in and acted like she was a much bigger deal than she is and talked down to AEW while paying what felt like insincere lip service towards, you know, how great AEW looked from afar. But it was sort of like that Christian Cage thing, you know, oh, it looked great from afar. And when I showed up, everybody worshipped me because I'm such a big star. And it's like, she's kind of Christian Cage level in terms of women. Nothing to be ashamed of, good career, but not a top act. You know, she's not Becky Lynch or Charlotte and or Sasha Banks, you know, but she presented herself or carried herself that way. So I think this is smart. I think she's talented. I think she's has a real presence to her, but, you know, she's going to be a better heel than a face based on what I've seen.
Yeah. It to me, it's like, MJF, some people have been, I think maybe even you have been critical of his character since coming back at All Out after his 3 months, let's not call it a suspension. Let's just call it, whatever it was, holdout, whatever it was, after he cut the Tony Khan promo, but MJF, tried to baby, you know, he sort of baby faced himself. And then since then, he's had to go so lowest common denominator, cheap heel heat, you know, sports teams in the city before the AEW Dynamite goes on the air to just mean, you know, ensure that he's going to be received as a heel and be such a fierce heel because people wanted to cheer him, right? With Saraya, it's, I guess it's the opposite. She was so bad on the mic and so off, not non-babyface, even though that was the role she was cast in. Now they got to turn her.
Yeah. I mean, I want my takeaway from that segment is I'm intrigued with what's going on in the women's division. But your point of the integration of Britt Baker and her crew, and also does Jade Cargill ever stop feuding in the Jadeverse or the Cargillverse? You know, like, you know, we accused Cody of, rightfully so, kind of doing, you know, at some point, and maybe it's good to kind of have her on a separate track. It's almost like a informal brand split. So when she crossed paths with some names who are really finally established, when they are ready for Jade to have some give and take in terms of finishes and not just, you know, maybe getting to win 50 will be the key. Is it 50? Is that what she's building towards? She mentioned that on Rampage on Friday, I think.
I thought she was in the low 40s, but I don't know if they've I don't know if they've Goldberg fast forwarded that or not.
Well, my point was, she wasn't like 100 or anything. So it must be 50 that she was talking about. I just wanted to fact check myself. So maybe when she gets to that point, they'll feel like they've gone far enough and they can kind of, and she's come along enough in the ring, they can, and on the mic, that they can integrate her a little bit and mix up some of the talent. But yeah, so they have multiple things going on without a lot of, with some overlap, but not necessarily overlap everywhere. And then some people on the sidelines, including Nyla Rose. You know, Serena Deeb is still out there, I think. Abaddon has a little cult following out there. So, yeah, we'll see. But I think there is some, I'm trying to think. You mentioned Chris Statlander. I don't think I mentioned her. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm leaving anyone out. But, yeah, I mean, there's a decent depth chart, and the idea is form balance with heels and faces and have them be, you know, clearly in a certain role and have build storylines around them. And in a way, having a show lighter on major angles and blockbuster promos and that kind of thing, I think helped the angle with Tony and Saraya stand out more. And in that sense, it helped it not just get completely lost in the mix.
So reacting to what you said, in some ways, there are no two bigger homegrown women in AEW than both Jade and Britt Baker, right? And then Jamie Hayter, yeah, to an extent, although she was not around during the pandemic much due to travel restrictions, I think. I think, boy, Jade is already over, although she doesn't feel as hot as an act to me as she once was, mostly because, as you point out, she's sort of been stuck beating jobbers or lower level talent from the roster or squash matches as they protect the streak. The streak is like a blessing and a curse for her. Boy, Jade coming out and you think she's a heel, but she's homegrown and she defends the homegrown team. I mean, she still has the streak. That would be a huge babyface turn. And Britt, the same thing, right? The fans always are about half a click away from cheering Britt Baker on any given night anyway. So you could go all in if you wanted it. And I guess, you know, Hayter is homegrown. Yeah, I mean, there are, it's not perfect, right? There are some bridges you'd have to cross due to who's homegrown and who's not and, how you define that. But I guess it seems interesting that there's longer than like a 1 or 2 week angle and storyline playing out in the AEW women's division. That's not something we always get.
Yeah. Yep. The email that Zach wrote, it also brought up MJF's promo. And I this is a talking point too on the show, which is just, this was not a shock jock promo. This wasn't creating internet buzz with an OMG. I can't believe he said that. This was just a straight forward, this is going to get worse for you, Bryan Danielson, not better. And there was a sinisterness to the tone and an understatedness. And as Zach brought up, you know, Jake Roberts made you listen because he talked softly when everyone else was yelling. And MJF's, it's my least favorite part of his promos, is when he overmodulates. You know, when he starts yelling into the mic and it's just, the audio gets screwed up. Because then I just, I'm more irritated than interested in what he's saying at that point. This had me listening carefully, leaning in to listen. And I liked it. And it had purpose too, you know, and then that was followed up with Brian Cage segment. What did you think? Is MJF good at this? Is this something he should do more often, a lot more often, or as an occasional one-off? And what do you think of the setup for Brian Cage as Danielson's next opponent?
So I guess about MJF's promo and the way he cut it, the big difference between the normal MJF promo that you don't always like for the reasons you stated, and tonight, this was a pre-tape. It's not like Danielson was reacting to what he said and firing back. So my guess is, I'm not even sure if MJF was there tonight. They both this and the Cage thing were pre-taped, and I don't know what kind of other stuff MJF has going on, or what his contract says about how many dates he has to be there. But that's something to watch, right? Did he not do all the cheap shots because it was a shorter pre-tape, as opposed to go out and fill 10 minutes with your wit and wisdom thing? So, you know, I mean, I thought it's interesting because this storyline started out as Danielson wanting to get revenge for William Regal back in November when all of this started, when they did that, you know, they were writing Regal off TV and it all got kind of a little nonsensical for a while. And Tony Khan had some distractions with his mother's health and that, as I stated in my Torch article. No mention of that anymore. What was interesting to me about the promo is MJF is getting more and more frustrated as Bryan Danielson pulls off these wins, right? And he's getting frustrated because at the end of the day, the bottom line is MJF is a chicken shit and he doesn't want to face Bryan Danielson at the pay-per-view. He wants anything but to have a 60-minute Iron Man match against Bryan Danielson. And so his frustration is mounting, and you're seeing that in the promos, which makes sense and is logical and is good. To your other question about setting up Brian Cage, one of my pre-show notes was, who exactly is it that's determining the opponents week to week for Bryan Danielson? Is it MJF? Like, we've seen the gauntlet thing in the past. Is it Tony Khan? And I guess tonight they answered it that it's Tony Khan. Tony Khan has picked Brian Cage as the next opponent.
Yeah,
I mean, my reaction to that was, well, I guess Brian Cage certainly is capable of doing a job to Bryan Danielson without any harm to his character. And the MJF thing where he – where you know, he gave – it didn't make total sense to me because he held out the envelope, and I thought he was saying you'll get the money if you break his arm. But then he gave him the money – it gave him the money before he walked away. Did I miss something in there?
I think that's right.
Yeah. So, like, she didn't break the arm yet, so why is he giving him the money? Or was he just so scared to death of Cage going after him because he pissed him off that, you know, I don't know.
I think he's just paying him ahead of time. You know, just saying, go do, here's money, go, and he doesn't doubt he'll want to do it.
Yeah, what happens if... he fails, which is probably going to happen. I don't know.
Well, he's already got a bunch of money. Yeah. And he already has a bunch of money.
Yeah. And I lost my train of thought there. Sorry.
That's all right.
I know what I was going to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
So
yep.
MJF is known for we need to phone a friend here and get Todd Martin on the blower. MJF is known for dipping into the past wrestling annals, you know, Roddy Piper promos and, you know, different promos and angles, not unlike Cody Rhodes. And I feel like during the early to mid 80s, there was, you know, a bounty to break somebody's arm. Was that an angle against Dusty Rhodes, against the Andersons? I know in the wrestling in the past has had, you know, in the 80s, especially, it was popular to for a heel who was chicken bleep like MJF to pay off another heel to try and take somebody out. Right. Any of that coming to mind that where MJF might be cribbing from?
No, I think it could be more a collage, pulling from a variety of sorts. It didn't jump out as like one particular person other than the Jake Roberts example, you know, fit.
Yeah. I know there have been break the guy's arm or break the guy's leg angles in the past. I can't really remember any of them off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, it's been done often enough.
Right? I think that's what they were called, bounties. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that stuff's been done often enough. There's not like a single person that you think of when it comes to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I was looking at the email while you were talking, so I wanted to pull up the other thing that he brought up that I wanted to bring up. Danielson and Bandido. This relates to the MJF thing. What'd you think of the match, and what'd you think of the I don't know if introduction is a word, but the way what they did to get people invested in Bandido? Because we had Bandido and we had Kushida on this show as wrestlers who aren't super regulars against big names. You know, I mean, Starks and Hager has a backstory on Dynamite. Jay Lethal and Orange Cassidy has a backstory from AEW TV. Even Willow and Tony Storm did. Kushida and Bandido, less so. This was more about, this is going to be a really good match, people. Did you like what they did to introduce them? Because, you know, good matches are good. Good matches with context and meaning and a high percentage of the audience invested in what happens is even better. How did they do? How do you grade them in that respect here?
I mean, I thought what they did to introduce Kushida was smart and important, and I'm glad they did it. They had ROH and New Japan footage they could use. Did they introduce Bandido or reintroduce him? It's possible I missed that. What did they do for Bandido?
They just talked him up.
Okay. They didn't do a video package, right? They talked him up. Did they mention that Danielson and Bandido were both former ROH champs or no?
I don't remember. I don't remember that. The announcers, they touted that really the big sales pitch for Bandido when he was coming out is how varied his offense is. He's got high flying and he can do groundwork and he's tough. And they just, you know, just kind of sold you on what to expect from him as an opponent of Danielson. And then we kind of saw that in the match. So I think it was built. I think the announcers were queued up to say it because it was the structure of the match, which was
right.
A lot of mat wrestling at the beginning and then some more high flying and then some toughness and submissions.
Yeah, which of course, when people do mat wrestling at the beginning of a match, instead of praising them for trying to show off the mat wrestling they can do, it always gets buried on Twitter as, oh, the match started off slow. And it's like, well, that's what mat wrestling is. It's inherently slow, but it's intricate. And if you've got, you know, like a Zack Sabre Jr. or Bryan Danielson, it's probably going to be pretty darn good, that part of the match. It's not, you know, I know I get that modern wrestling fans want the sugar, was your sugar rush your term? of a spot fest, but, you know, I appreciate a match that has, you know, several layers like that. And, you know, they mentioned Bandido is one of the strongest pound-for-pound guys, and that's true. He showed that off in this match. But Bandido is in sort of the Takeshita box, like great wrestler. Everyone knows they're great wrestlers, or the audience, you know the hardcore fans know they're great wrestlers. The audience is told they're great wrestlers, and yet they never win on television. They're always there. They're like the highest profile good match enhancement guys you'll ever see, right? So that's sort of the downside is it's hard to establish Bandito's credibility when all the fans have ever done is see him lose. Sorry, I had a cough. The match was great. I don't think they've worked together before, as Excalibur alluded to. Like, Danielson was in a place where he couldn't wrestle luchadors. I think Bandito wasn't high profile. I think he's not old enough to have been around in any kind of prominent way when Danielson was in Ring of Honor, but his pre-WWE days. I thought the match was great. I liked it. Observations I had: the Danielson's running knee, the Bosaiko knee, seems like a secondary finisher for him. Usually, he puts somebody in some sort of torture type submission move, the cattle mutilation or variations of that, like he was doing in his feud against Hangman Page last year. And he didn't do that here. He hit him with a secondary maneuver that doesn't do wonders to make Bandido seem.
I do not have it in front of me, but it seems to me that he has been winning with that, or you know maybe it's been a setup to a finish, but I think he's won with that at least
he
once.
Has. He's just not beating. He didn't beat top guys with it. He was beating like Dark Order members, and so more. You know, since the Blackpool Combat Club was formed, he was more of a submission guy. Anyway, so that to me did not do wonders to make Bandido. A bigger deal, and Bandito's push may be coming at some point. And then the other thing was, because they hadn't worked together before, I was watching the match pretty closely to see how the magic tricks are done. And a few times there was a little bit of pausing between moves, like brief pauses here and there to make sure they kind of knew what the next sequence of spots were. So you could sort of see the stitches a little bit in this particular baseball, which is not, you know, I want the wrestlers to be safe. I know it's, predetermined stage for our entertainment. Just an observation I made about, you know, the craftsmanship tonight. So yes, it was a great match. I really liked it. Put it in my notebook for match of the year. Although, you know, I'm sure between New Japan and AEW and elsewhere, this will fall down out of my top 10. But what did you think of the match?
Oh, I liked it a lot. I mentioned the chapters of it, and I really liked the chapters, where there's kind of different moments in the match and different strategies that they each use because they hadn't had that experience against each other. So I liked it a lot. I'm not sure I have it in early match of the year list, but it seems like it's going to be one of many good matches that Danielson has, or the continuation of good matches Danielson has with opponents he wants. So this should not be billed as Tony Khan booked it, or it's an MJF challenge. It should be booked as this is the type of opponent that led to Bryan Danielson wanting to sign with us, because he wants to have that type of series of matches against people that he can do what you just talked about, which is explore working with somebody different than the repetitiveness that I think drove him a little insane in WWE.
I think when Danielson first got to the company in September of 2021, I think. Yes, that was the first year. And he basically did that. He went on a tear where he would just wrestle different people every week. Kenny Omega was one of them. They had that draw at the tennis stadium in New York at the first show. And then I think Mox had to go to rehab, and so Danielson quickly sort of pivoted to this heel persona, and he had to be he got the slot that in program with Hangman Page. But they've done that. Like CM Punk did that when he was in. He would wrestle. He would pick dudes that he wanted to wrestle, right? And they put him on TV, and Punk beat everybody, but gave him a lot in trying to put him over. And so that is an appeal, to your point, to get some of these veteran guys to come to AEW.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Another email. This from Josh, who says, "Do you think the spear is an effective finishing move for Ricky Starks? I continue to not be sold on it and think he should consider switching it up." Josh, I want to answer his question, but also talk about Starks this week and what they did as a follow-up to last week, including, by the way, not replaying, and I don't think they did on Rampage either when they hyped the match, his line about the lisp or speech impediment, which I thought was bad judgment last week. They didn't lean into it stubbornly or anything like that this week. What do you think of the presentation of Starks this week?
Well, he was a smart babyface in that when they had the numbers game at the end, instead of waiting in the ring to get his ass beat, it's 5-on-1 or whatever it was, 4-on-1, he hightailed it out of there into the fans. So that's a sort of smart babyface thing. I, too, liked that they didn't like, do you know when Ricky Starks' speech impediment lisp joke that he did last week, that was very much something The Rock as a babyface would have done in the Attitude Era, and it would have gotten over huge with the fans because that's the culture was a little rougher, coarser back then, and we're hopefully a little more evolved now. So that was a step in the right direction. I mean, I think it's, you know, now there's going to be, it's progressing logically. Now there's that sets up a tag match for next week, right? Which is where I figured this was going all along. It was going to be Action Andretti and Starks against, you know, pick two members of the Jericho Appreciation Society of their choosing. They did double duty here in that they furthered the Daniel Garcia, Sammy Guevara mentee thing. And if I circled the sentence, Guevara was okay with Garcia taking his place if he wins on Friday against Action Andretti Garcia. So are they going to do something where Action Andretti does the – Garcia slips on a banana peel and loses, or Guevara causes him to lose because he wants to protect his spot? So they did some things to develop the angle, you know, the angle and the storyline. And plus, Wade, we got a rare Jake Hager match.
Yes, and a loss, as it should be at this point.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they did not break – they had Chekhov's table. The table was never broken, I don't think.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Cool. All right. Let's shift. The spear. He asked about the spear. Did you comment on that? Okay, yeah.
We did not. I mean, I don't know. To me, there's only Roman Reigns is the only one who gets to use the spear and have it be a finisher. He's a really big dude. It looks really imposing, like it would take your wind out of you if he hit you with it. I think Brock Lesnar, of all people, last time, you know, he was put down, I think, at WrestleMania last year with the spear, right? A couple of spears. Ricky Starks, not as imposing, a little bit slighter, so... No, probably not a good finish for him. Maybe a good secondary finisher, but not his primary finisher.
Yeah, yep. I'm with you on that. All right, let's see. We'll go to Ryan in Cumberland, Mass. You are up now, Ryan. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
I have a question about the Hangman, Adam Page. He just say something to Renee, and he said, well, never mind, that's stupid. Do you think it was just say that he respects Moxley greatly, or think there was something else he was going to say to her?
Well, as the Torch's resident number one Hangman Page fan, by default, I'm guessing. I wondered today if they were going to continue that story with Moxley to set up a third match at the Revolution pay-per-view, and they didn't seem to do that. Page... It was weird because at the start of the promo, Paige did not seem overly worried about Mox getting knocked out last week, right? Like you would expect the anxious millennial cowboy to be, right? Because Paige was so, you know, worked up when he got knocked out that you would think he was, and he looked uncomfortable last week, right? That what did I do? It wasn't quite, oh my God, what have I done overacting, but it still looked like he was like a little bit questioning, oh, I did what I wanted to do and now I'm not sure how I feel about it. And then the only part that I think they followed up on that this week was the thing Ryan mentioned, which is Paige was going to say something, but then didn't. My guess would be what he was going to say is, hey, tell Mox I'm sorry, hope he gets better, but hey, I hope Mox is feeling better, I know what that was like, right? And then, you know, it would have been something that made him, that based on the context of what Paige said, Paige thought, well, if I say it, I'm going to look weak or I'm going to look silly or stupid, and so he didn't say it. You know, being anxious and a millennial and a cowboy. Wade, what do you think?
I think you covered it well. What did you think of that approach, the format of ending the interview, but then the camera kept rolling and we thought you'd be interested in this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, guess if you were a pessimist, you would say, oh, it's very WWE. Why is the camera even there, except they did establish why the camera was there, right? They just kept it rolling and they hadn't hit cut yet. But Paige and Renee both seemed to know they were still, you know, being recorded, right?
Yeah.
I guess it was an interesting little wrinkle. What I wanted coming out of this interview was to know if they were going for round three or if the feud was over. And I kind of don't feel like I got it. Instead, Renee asked the good question, well, what are you going to do next? And, you know, he said he's going to try and mend some fences. So is that with the Elite or the Dark Order, or as Wade sarcastically suggested, CM Punk? You know, I feel like the Dark Order thing is played out. We've seen that, right? Those guys be allies and break up, or, you know, before, maybe even more than once. I feel like one of the big angles AEW has left to run is Paige reuniting with the Bucks and Kenny. It's been a storyline that's been going on since literally the start of the promotion. Many twists and turns. You could have the mother of all video packages to encapsulate. But I always thought it would culminate with Hangman Paige making the save as the Bucks and Kenny were being beaten down by some heels. And it would culminate with all of them being faces, but that's not where the Elite are at now, right? They're heels.
Yeah.
Kenny for sure is. Don Callis is still around and being Don Callis, and kind of covers up for Kenny's being Kenny. And, you know, the Bucks were heels tonight against Top Flight and seem to enjoy it more when they're heels. So does this mean Hangman Page is going to turn heel? That was my conclusion / question mark I drew next to that. That doesn't feel right to me, right? That doesn't feel like something that the fans who've been following AEW since the start would love and pop for, whereas Paige reuniting and saving the day when they're really getting beaten down, that seems like the fans would go nuts for. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious if anybody else has any theories or favorites as far as that goes. Because, I mean, obviously they left it ambiguous with the idea being no one's going to know, or we want people to speculate about who he's talking about. I talked with Rich Van on the Everything VIP podcast yesterday, Everything with Rich and Wade. I don't want to see Adam Cole with, like, in a storyline with the Elite. I want to see people leaving their bubble and work and having fresh matchups and not, you know, as Rich and I talked about, talking about stuff in your senior year of college that happened in your junior year of high school. And that's what some of the stuff is starting to feel like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's plenty of places for Hangman Page to go. He didn't really have a lot to do last year after he lost the title to Punk at the end of May. So I was heartened when they started the feud with Moxley, because that gave him something to do against, you don't normally get two top-tier guys, you know, we don't get as often as maybe we would like two top-tier guys like that, push stars in AEW, feuding for a long time on TV and having matches on TV, right? Usually that's saved for pay-per-view, and so we got that here, and, you know, probably, I can't really think of any off the top of my head, but plenty of other matches Hangman Page could have.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, back to you.
I have a question about Billy Gunn. Looks like maybe he was starting to lose his patience with the Acclaim by saying act like champions. Do you think the Guns could possibly get their daddy back in sometime this year, or I think that's out of the question.
Yeah, on my snarky question about the top 15 stories of this Dynamite, that's one of them. You know, like one of the top stories of the show is what was going on with the Gun Boys and the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn. The Gun Boys have been saying, you know, that you stole our dad. Is that starting to tug on Billy's heartstrings at all? Is he starting to feel guilty? Is this a swerve? What's your takeaway from what they did tonight, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, my last note on this at the end was, does family therapy lead to a Billy Gunn turn, right?
Yes.
I assume they might have just – I feel like we've seen the Gun Club, the Gun Brothers versus the Acclaimed before. Like, we've seen a match already, like maybe even a title match.
Yeah.
But whatever the case, you know, this has certainly been a long-running – they're teamed up, and then they're feuding, and the Guns turn heel. And didn't Billy already – beat down the Acclaimed once before the Guns eventually turned on Billy? And I don't think I'm imagining that. And the Acclaimed made the save for Billy with them ever since. So, it's not the feud of the year for me, but it's been going on for seemingly a year. I thought the Guns initially depriving the fans of a rap was a good way to get heel heat on themselves, because that's one of the rituals you go to an AEW show for, right? You want to go sing Judas, and you want to hear the rap. The fact that he had to start the rap, he went back up the ramp and had to start the rap over, I feel like that was some sort of homage to, or callback to, if you're online, you would know this. He, at the taping of Rampage last week, he screwed up the rap at first, blanked, and then had to go back up the ramp and start over, and said, we can start this over because we're not live. I did not, the one thing I'm missing here that Brian brought up, I did not see what was it that the Acclaimed were doing that caused Billy Gunn to tell them to act like champs?
Good question. It's not just the rapping, because they always do that. Ryan, do you know what that was? I'll throw it to you.
I'm not sure on if he thought that they were just getting a little bit too carried away or rambunctious, you know, because it wasn't even like a match or anything. Maybe he wants them to save their energy for a championship match instead of just fighting, would be my guess.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah, I didn't catch it, but I certainly, Billy Gunn, I think he's been quoted as saying that he doesn't always come out right away or try and be in a prominent spot when they're walking to the ring, because he wants these guys to get over as opposed to himself. I guess parenthetically, he just saves that for when he's in a match.
Yeah,
takes all the offense, but at least his heart's in the right spot, with that, and so. I mean, I guess Billy Gunn turning would be his nature, and I don't know what's going on. Is this just, hey, we need a program for the Acclaimed, and this is the best idea we can come up with, or are the T-shirt sales dipping, or is Billy Gunn tired of tired and forcing a trade? I have no idea, but certainly seemed at least like they were hinting that possibility.
Yeah. I would be okay with Billy leaving the Acclaimed and going back with his sons and then them splitting off and doing separate things for a while. I think the Acclaimed, I think the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn have genuine chemistry. And I think they enjoy working together, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like a long-term thing any longer than, I don't think it has to go on indefinitely. I think moving on from it, letting the Acclaimed just be the Acclaimed works.
Yeah, I'm not chalking this one up in the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express, all-time great feuds here. Briscoe's Bucks, yeah, this is not that, right? I mean, I don't know, maybe it will end up being the defining tag team feud. It's not there for me.
and I'm a fan of Austin and Colton as a heel act. Yeah, I mean, it's fine that they get a push. I think they're good, kind of mid-card obnoxious heels, and they're good bump takers and obnoxious personalities. And so, I mean, a lot of that works. I just think the Acclaimed, it is kind of time to move on. And maybe this will be, you know, Billy Gunn's tough love kind of saying, hey, guys, let's move on to bigger and better things than my son. Maybe that's kind of part of what's going on.
Could Billy Gunn turn on the Acclaimed and cost them the titles, leading to the Gunn Bros as kind of a transitional champ? I don't know who would get the belts after that. Top Flight? I don't even know who's ready. The Bucks. FTR are on the shelf for a few months.
Yeah, they are.
I don't know. Just playing it out. I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. All right. Ryan, what else have you got for us?
I have a question on Sting that he was in the main event segment. I heard his contract is running out this year. Do you have any specifics on when exactly that's happening or if they have any chance of renewing that contract? Because I heard he may not renew this year.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. I do not have specifics. We could probably, you know, march back the time that he debuted and figure it's around a 1 year anniversary of that, but not necessarily because you can renegotiate a deal midstream and set it to zero at that point. Eric, what do you think about Sting and his value to Darby and really overall that we're talking about him, how they've utilized him?
So I think Sting debuted in December of 2020 at Winter is Coming. So if he signed a 3-year deal, which seems like a thing they were doing at the time, or, you know, 3 with option years for a lot of guys, that would seem to be the case. And, I mean, you know, Sting said as much in that interview. I think it was called D Magazine, out of Dallas, maybe it was. I don't know what Sting's – I could be wrong about that. But what his Dallas ties are. But, I think – so they've kind of never – Sting has had great – some great performances in AEW for a man of his age and, you know, and a legend of his stature. He's done more in the ring and crazy bumps and stunts, maybe more than we ever even wanted him to, right, to risking his own health. They've never moved him away from Darby. Like, his entire thing when he got there, and I remember Cody Rhodes being in the ring with him early, like, fanboying out, oh, my God. Like, it may be literally his introductory thing may have, or in the first few weeks, it was Cody being like, oh, my God, Sting's here, blah, blah, blah. And Sting saying, Cody, I'm here, but it's not for you. It's for Darby. And they haven't done anything else with it, right? I mean, it's 2+ years now, and Sting and Darby are up and down the roads, and they've sort of started to give hints of, you know, Darby telling Sting not to come to ringside for one of his recent defenses, and so I can't imagine they're going to do a thing where Sting turns or Darby turns. That just nobody wants that, right? They're both of them are going to Japan next month for the Great Muta's final match, I believe, or is it with Keiji Muto?
Yeah.
Or no, I think it's as Great Muta because they're all of them will have their faces painted. I think that's the gimmick there. I don't know. What would you do with Sting if this is the last 10, 11 months of his on-screen career? Or so he says at this point. You know, it also could be a negotiating ploy, I suppose, knowing his deal is coming up. I mean, do you feud the two of them? Do they do a match?
I don't
face-to-face or, you know, Hogan Warrior before he wraps
I think you just find the right tag team for them to team together against and keep it simple. I don't think we need an angle where Sting turns on Darby or Darby turns on Sting. It feels kind of cliche, and I just don't think fans – to me, it's sort of like, you know, Hawk versus Animal or Matt versus Jeff Hardy or Ricky versus Robert. Like, I just don't think that's something people are clamoring for.
I think it is possible that Sting has not done a job since he's been in AEW. I can't think of one. And so what the – you know, traditionally in wrestling, the sort of highest, best use when you're – you know, you would want to use Sting maybe to do a job, right, so it's meaningful, for his way out, either to build epic heel heat, you know, for some sort of rematch, right, that's his last match or whatever the case may be or something over the summer. That would be a way, you know, make Sting or use Sting's rub and beating Sting as a way to get somebody over, right, to elevate somebody. And so – interesting to see if they go that route or he just remains undefeated at age early 60s for his entire three-year run in AEW.
What could Sting do to create – like, who's on that list of people that he could face that in lose to that would – that you could imagine conjuring up a scenario where it would actually elevate somebody?
Yeah, I can't think of it. Like, so it would be a young heel.
Yeah.
I don't think at one point I would say MJF, but he's he's the top guy now. He's the champ, so I don't feel like that's the case. Daniel Garcia doesn't seem to have the ring presence, promo ability yet to do such a thing. I hate to waste it on Sammy Guevara just because he's so obnoxious.
Yeah, but I mean that's a good answer though.
Yeah,
that's a good answer.
But like what they used to call the four pillars, except a heel pillar, or somebody who's since become a pillar, who's a heel, and that's I guess. Like people who need elevation, Jungle Boy, Darby, a little bit. I mean, I'd make the argument Darby is probably elevated about as high maybe as his ceiling might be as holding the secondary title in AEW. I'm not sure people buy him as a world title contender, maybe on TV, not necessarily a pay-per-view match. You could have Darby challenge for the title and lose, I suppose. But Darby and Sammy and Jungle Boy, three of the four pillars, are still in need of elevation to reach that MJF level, right?
Yeah.
But they're not, they're not heels, two of the three of them. So I don't know. I'll
yeah.
stand on that answer.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, anything else for us?
I'm a little bit confused why MJF gave the money to Brian Cage without him doing anything, because if you remember, Triple H didn't give Batista the money to take out Goldberg till Batista literally destroyed Goldberg.
Yeah, I don't know. I had
the same question earlier.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, we talked about that earlier, Ryan, and I think MJF just is like, win or lose, just go beat him up. I know you will, and here's some incentive. I'm paying ahead of time. It's like Peacock. They paid WWE ahead of time for big WrestleMania numbers. They didn't wait for them to come in before paying them. Ryan, anything else?
I think Darby and Sting is the way to go, but let's keep them both face, like, say, when 1-2-3 Kid wrestled Bret Hart for the world title, and nobody turned heel, and then when... or no turns, just the basic match. This may be something for Darby to prove himself that he's finally on his way to being a star.
Eric?
Yeah, I mean, Sting putting over Darby in his last match, I guess would be somewhat would be acceptable.
A disagreement, but not a heel turn, and it's Sting feels like he owes he wants to teach Darby a lesson, but in the end, Darby gets the win and they hug. I mean, yeah, you can work a story out there.
I mean, you could always do the Hogan Warrior WrestleMania finish where Sting does the job and then pops up right back afterwards immediately, no selling everything and raising Darby's hand and putting the spotlight on Sting. Oh wait, no, that probably isn't what you want to do. That certainly didn't help the Ultimate Warrior.
All right. Ryan, appreciate the call. Well, did you have anything else? I didn't keep track of how many topics you had.
No, that was everything I had, and thanks for putting me on first this time.
Sure thing. Absolutely. Thanks, Ryan. Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland, and up next, David from North Carolina. David, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite? Oh, my switchboard's screwing up here. Okay. There you are. Now it's lit up. Hey, David.
Hi. How are you guys doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can.
Can you hear me? Okay. So my first question was, Top Flight losing to the Young Bucks, that's kind of a big deal. And I was going to ask, what do you think they should follow that up with? What should be the follow-up to that?
Yeah, Eric had a good idea earlier that it's a setup for a trios title match. And having the Bucks leave the trios division, and they made a big deal out of that on commentary for this match, And then to lose does, you know, set them up. And, I mean, that's – they don't have a lot of three-man teams for that division, so setting up a loss did it seem too fluky, Eric, for you? The loss, or did it seem like, no, that was well-earned, and that would move them into number one contendership status if they grabbed a partner?
Yeah, I mean, their partner is AR Fox. They've had some six-man matches. I think they were in the tournament and lost to Death Triangle, maybe, last year in the six-man tournament. For sure, and, you know, the benefit of having a partner in AR Fox means, you know, he's brought in, he can lose, and then Top Flight hasn't given the Bucks their win back that quickly, right? It's sort of and with their tag team straight up record being 2-1, you know, can Top Flight even it up down the road or not? If you don't do the six man route, you could, you know, Wade suggested maybe that puts them up the ranks for the tag title, but, you know, the Acclaimed are babyface champions. You could do a babyface match, but I don't necessarily know that that's where you'd want to go right now. But certainly, you could have Excalibur say Top Flight beat the Young Bucks in a tag match. They're now the number one contenders, even though we really don't update that webpage anymore. You could go that route. I think the six-man thing is more likely, though, would be my guess.
Have they ever mentioned their website on Dynamite, Eric?
AWTix.com? Or you mean just the regular?
All Elite Wrestling. Yeah, the regular.
Yeah. The ticket one, I think they have. I don't know that they've mentioned the regular website.
Yeah. What else, David?
Yeah. Well, what do you, okay, beyond that, what do you think they should do with them? As far as, let's say they lose. Do they just, this is a monumental moment for them. Do they just forget this happened? Do they go back to Dark or Dark Elevation? Or do they use this to catapult them beyond that match?
I think catapult. I think they're ready to not just be a team that loses a lot, but actually gets pushed consistently. And if they can stay healthy, it's a homegrown team that you can count on for good matches. I mean, obviously, they're, you know, the personality / promo area needs work, but you know, my thinking is that Eric's right. This will be a trios match, and it'll be not for a pay-per-view, and it's just they're trying to set up a match to answer the question that people have about who are the Bucks and Kenny, who's in line to face them.
My next question was, you know, okay, so I'm really interested in the Brian Cage Danielson match, because I think that's going to be a great clash of styles. And obviously, Cage is going to lose in the match. But do you think he should succeed in seriously injuring Danielson's arm? Because it could make, that could be an interesting story. I mean, if he were to truly fulfill what MJF is hoping, let's say in KFAP dislocates a shoulder or something, and they have to put it back in, and then we could kind of play up the idea in the storyline that he has to win the rest of his matches in his MJF feud with the injured arm, or they could do something like, you know, have him rehabbing the arm. Is it going to be 100% for the Iron Man match that's coming up? Will he make it? Will he not make it? And kind of replicate one of my favorite storylines, which was Seth Rollins versus Triple H at WrestleMania, when they were playing up whether he would make it or not make it with his knee injury.
Yeah.
What do you think?
That path you laid out would make sense if this was the last match he had a win and Brian Cage took out his arm. But I think now, I don't think they've said this since, but I'm pretty sure when they first laid down this gauntlet challenge for Danielson, I want to say he had to win every match through February 8th Dynamite, which would mean after the 25th, next week when he takes on Brian Cage, he'd have two more matches, the 1st of February and the 8th of February, in those Dynamites with opponents to be named. And if it seems like if you were going to do that injury angle that successfully takes him out, that sets up a problem for the next two matches. How is he supposed to win those matches? Logically, you want that injury to happen in the last match, and that he's got roughly a month, 3 weeks to the Revolution pay-per-view in early March. And you could do it that way. So I think, David, you are higher on the Cage Danielson match than I am at this point.
Okay. I was thinking it'd be an interesting storyline to be interested in wrestling those matches in general.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, the idea of Cage not knocking him completely out, but knocking him into a more vulnerable position against a couple more opponents that adds some actual, you know, drama to whether, not whether Danielson's going to have the match with MJF, but maybe whether he will have that. Now he's at a disadvantage in the match that he thought would give him an advantage. And I think there's a way to tell that story and kind of go halfway with an injured arm, but not so injured he can't win a couple more matches.
Danielson is going to need an excuse when he loses to MJF at Revolution, right? You need a little bit of protection baked in for him because this will be his, second time going for the world title, and he's not going to win it, I assume. I mean, it's possible that MJF, has a movie that he's going to shoot that we just don't know about, and Danielson will beat him for the title. That would seem really premature in a year that I think is supposed to be MJF's year in AEW. So, yeah.
David, I
hope that – I really hope that that Danielson does not beat him, and I would love to see Danielson as champion at some point, but I think that they need to solidify somebody as being ultra-dominant and also an original from their company, and MJF's definitely the guy to do that. So, yeah, I hope that – I agree. I hope that they don't have him can beat him. Let's see. You know, it's a sensitive subject, and I missed the beginning of the podcast. If you already discussed it, then I apologize. I had technical issues with my phone. But do you believe they should have done more to honor Jay Briscoe? I know people on Twitter were saying that they should have done a 10-bell salute, and as we all know, Twitter speaks for everyone on Earth. And I was wondering what y'all thought.
Yeah, Eric, are you surprised at what they did and what they didn't do for Jay tonight?
So I saw some of the discourse on Twitter. Look, they were in a tough spot. Jay Briscoe never actually appeared on AEW TV, right, at all, because of presumably the reporting has been that his anti-gay marriage comments about nearly a decade ago led, Warner Brothers Discovery to tell Tony Khan, nope, you can't have the Briscoes on TV, because obviously Tony Khan, they were his main pushed act in Ring of Honor along with FTR for the first year that Tony Khan owned it. So my guess is they were in a bad spot, and their solution was, Matt and Nick Jackson did the Doomsday Device in their tag match that Excalibur noted was a Briscoe's favorite. Jay Lethal had an armband on in his match. Danielson and Bandito both had armbands on. I mean, so I think the performers in AEW who had connections, actual connections to the Briscoes, wore the armbands. The only clunky part to me was that Excalibur said, I think it was during the first match, might have been the second match, he said, hey, don't worry, fans. It had the feeling of Tony Khan being in his ear, and he's like, don't worry, fans, we will do more to honor Jay Briscoe later. And then they never followed up on it on the show, I don't think.
Yeah.
Now, if you were following Tony Khan's Twitter account, you would know he initially said, don't worry, we're going to tape something at the end here, and you can watch it for free on the Ring of Honor, the Honor Club website, and then he had to clean that tweet up when he started getting criticized. He's like, let me be clear, it's going to be free for everybody. When you're in Gorilla running a show and you're trying to type a tweet and you're not as clear as you might be and you leave room for interpretation, that's kind of what he stepped in. So, I look forward to seeing whatever tribute they're going to do. But as for the notion that they could do a similar tribute like they did for Brody Lee, I mean, they couldn't. I mean, I think they would have gotten in trouble with Warner Brothers Discovery, with whom they are studying they're hoping to get a contract renewal and a bigger, an increase. You don't want to piss off your partners. What did you think, Wade?
I thought it was fine. I was expecting more, but I understand why they did what they did, especially because he wasn't technically an AEW wrestler, and even he wasn't among the ROH wrestlers who had been appearing. on AEW Dynamite, and I'm sure the next ROH, you know, event is going to, you know, the next pay-per-view that Tony promotes is going to have a big thing for him, and that's fine. I thought it was appropriate, but I'm not surprised that people wanted more, you know, for somebody who had been around that long and is connected to, so connected to the group that Tony Khan owns besides AEW. Yeah. David, anything else for us? Anything else for us?
Well, on the Jay Briscoe note, and I can only speak for myself. And they have to piece Warner Brothers Discovery because that is their bread and butter. But as a gay man, it was very hurtful at the time, but it was like 10 years ago, and he apologized for it, and I don't understand the philosophy of you mess up once in life and there's no forgiveness and we have to hold that over you forever in perpetuity. It seems so counterproductive to people getting along, and the people who want to, on Twitter, who are just bringing it up in threads about his passing, and that's just so gross. And it seems like, as a society, like we are falling apart because we cannot forgive each other for mistakes that we make in the past. It ruins legacies. I feel like it's ruining lives. And I feel like, in this case, it's counterintuitive to people who would want to change because they would think, why would I ever want to change if my one mistake is forever? And that's, I guess, my thought on that.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the way you put that and where you're coming from. Todd Martin and I talked earlier on the Fix podcast about this. And, you know, my thinking was this would not have been as big of a deal if Jay was against gay marriage. I mean, I don't think it should become legal. I mean, no, President Obama ran on that, on that position. You know, we're not that far removed from it. And that was 10 years ago. That said, I think the issue was, if you teach my son it's okay, I'll shoot you. Like, that's the part that I think is hard to get past, that it wasn't, I disagree on something because of my religion, which is what he said, you know, last year, that he thought he was serving the Lord by taking a stand against it. But it was the fact that he threatened violence against anyone who would teach acceptance. And I think that holds on longer. It doesn't take away from what you said, David. The people, so many people who I really respect as really good people in this business, really genuinely liked Jay and Mark, and say good things about them, who would absolutely not edit themselves privately to me. I'm not saying they tweet it out, but they would tell me if they're like, yeah, this guy wasn't a good dude. That's not what I'm hearing from anybody who knew him. So I don't know. It's part of it. It affected his career. You know, I mean, it's part of the story in the sense that that's why he wasn't on AEW TV over the past year. And so it's part of the story. But is it his defining trait? I mean, no, of course not. And redemption and ability to kind of, you know, not walk back, but grow and acknowledge the mistake and doing so in a way that seems genuine, I think does deserve credit. I think there should be ramifications for those mistakes, but I don't think that it should just be you know, something that is forever the number one thing that defines you, especially when you're much more than your kind of worst public moment. And I would say that's probably his worst public moment. Anything you want to add, Eric?
Well, as the only non-gay person in this conversation, I don't feel like it's my place to say whether people should have been offended or whether they should have not been offended about Jay Briscoe. I certainly was offended by the comment when I learned about it years after the fact, when I learned why the Briscoes were never in WWE or AEW. I agree, you both said, and think as a society, we're still grappling with kind of what is the path back if you've done a really bad thing or said a really bad thing. What do you have to do to sort of, you know, get back on maybe not an even playing field, but, you know, resume somewhat of your former life? And I mean, I think it depends on the circumstances of what you did, you know, murder and the Me Too movement, you know, Harvey Weinstein not coming back, Bill Cosby not coming back to polite society. They did horrible things. In this particular case, you know, someone apologizes profusely and you know, Ian Riccoboni, I think, talked about how he is, I think Ian said he's bisexual recently, and he also, I think, talked about how he had forgiven, you know,
James. Yeah, he had heart-to-heart with him, yeah.
Yeah, and so I guess if there was ever a path for restorative justice, it seemed like Jay Briscoe met that. Not my, you know, again, not my call to make here, but just broadly speaking, yeah, what do you do? You know, how sincere do you, who gets to decide how sincere you are? Who gets to decide how, you know, if you're, if you get to come back or not? We haven't worked that out as a society yet. Twitter certainly not helpful in that regard.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I want to be very clear that I do think what he said was awful and repugnant. It was hurtful to me at the time. But I also, like Wade was saying, and like what you said, is that growth is important, and I think that we should encourage the growth, and it really did seem like he was sincere, as people do change. You know, there was a time in my dad's life where, you know, he thought being gay was a choice, and he had, he had some pretty strong opinions. My brother, he called me a word I can't say on here, and he's grown up to change his opinions and become a different person. And I think that you saw, he didn't have the insane incentive somebody working for WWE would have to be as apologetic as he was. And I do think that I can't speak for any other gay person on the planet except for myself, but to me he made the amends that would be enough to say, okay, I get it, I forgive you. And that should be that, because if you forgive somebody, the saying is, you can bury a hatchet, but we have a sign like right stuck above it going, hatchet right here in case of need. That's not very buried. And so, if you say, if he's done what he can, I mean, then you should forgive them and move on. And that's how I look at it. I look at, to me, the more defining moments of his career were the last three matches he had with FTR than anything he said decades ago that was repugnant, awful, and hurtful at that time, but he made up for it.
And his apology wasn't, well, to those I might have offended, his apology was, I said one of the dumbest things that one could possibly say, and I'm ashamed. You know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here. But, I mean, his words were not one of those eye-rolling apologies where you're like, this person isn't taking accountability. So, you know, that combined with just one testimonial after another about what a good person he was, I think that should factor in to people online who are commenting about this and reacting to it.
And I guess at the risk of taking this off the rails, there's a very glaring, obvious comparison point in WWE right now where Vince McMahon has come back without any remorse, any apology for all of the things that the Wall Street Journal has reported that he paid money to settle. And so, you know, man, what a glaring neon sign that is.
Yes. David,
exactly.
Andy,
that's the kind of thing we should not encourage. Is that, you know, that's actually a very good point and a very good contrast to point out what you should and should not do in a case like that. And Vince McMahon, if there was like a map, if someone could draw a picture or make a movie of everything you should never, ever do when you do something awful, it's exactly what Vince McMahon has done. I can't
well
think
said,
of
David.
Anything
yes.
he could do to make it worse than maybe accidentally tweet a picture of his penis.
No, you didn't need to put that out into the podcast sphere.
Sorry about that. If you need to edit that out, I'm not very good at editing myself. Very well. But,
God damn it, David.
That's all
shit.
I have.
That was my bad.
That's really all I have. Another note that I don't know if you knew that I was watching on the international feed because I got a friend of mine from Australia that I watched the show with, and the audio kept messing up bad. The people in the Fight TV forums, they were not clear on that audio messing up, and I just really hope that AEW can get those kinds of things fixed, because those kinds of things can drive off new fans that are tuning in the first time.
Yeah,
that's
my
last
comment.
David, I really hope I can find a VPN.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Thank you.
Find a VPN service that David is using so I can go back to watching the Fight TV feed like I was doing for a month. I don't have that anymore, Mike.
I'm using Discord to watch it with my friend in Australia.
Yep,
so it's
makes
his
sense.
Subscription.
Yep.
Yes. So it's how they did that. But, yeah, I do like it. It's really nice to not have those commercial breaks and to be able to see the match continue. Like, you don't even know the commercial break happens except for you sort of can tell that the sign-off. And they just keep going with the show. And I'm like, this is nice. Like, I've been missing this for a long time. Yeah.
Sometimes JR would say
have an option to pay for
JR would say stuff on the international feed he would not say on the American feed, which was interesting to me.
Oh, you know, they think they're getting away with it, but it gets amplified in other ways.
I miss Jim Ross.
Cool.
I really do. I wish they'd bring him back. I would love to have him on mic again.
Yeah, I mean he's good. He's good on Rampage. I mean he gets to. He's not in as busy of a booth on a Rampage, but
he's like that grandpa who just sort of being grouchy all the time, but it's great, and it's just like hilarious. I mean, he's always insightful to me, but he's thinking because he always says what he's thinking, and I think that's valuable too. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, David. Great hearing
for
from
having
you.
Me.
Good to talk to you.
Absolutely, 100%.
All right, let's keep rolling through. Eric, I'll go back to the email here. Okay, this was Jay from Hartford who says, "I'm a week behind in commenting on the final match in the best of seven, but Kenny Omega did something at the end of the match that I'd classify as a hidden highlight. He first retrieved one of the titles to give his team the win. Then he struggled to hold on to the first title while grabbing the other two belts to pass along to his partners. It was seemingly his way of saying, this is that belt that I grabbed to give us the win, and I'm keeping this one as mine. It might not be a big deal to some, but it really stood out to me and made me appreciate Omega more than I have in some time. It tells me it meant something to Kenny, and it made the Trails Championship seem that much more important. Secondly, on that topic, I'm not a fan of the Trails Championship, but the fact that they constantly reference the NBA game gave me an idea. They've got enough championships as it is, and traditionally, you have more two-man teams than trails. Why not have the Trails Championship defended yearly, and only once yearly, in a best-of-seven series? It's simple, I think. You come to that time of year designated for the title defense, and the trio with the most victories from the prior year gets the title shot in a best-of-seven. It differentiates this championship from others and gives them more of a reason to reference the NBA. R.I.P. Jay Briscoe. It's about time I watch a Briscoe Brothers match. Eric, what do you think?
Well, on his first point about Kenny selling the belt thing, like he was injured, and that was the only selling that went on in that entire match, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Because they just went bam, 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 bam. It was almost like they shaved 5 minutes off the time because they were running behind, and you know, they were going to get all their stuff in that best of seven match. I think in terms of once a year best of seven series, I think you'd need a really compelling matchup or feud to justify a best of seven. Not any two teams can pull off the best of seven. You'd need special circumstances and a special storyline. And I'm not a fan of when WWE creates the War Games match just because, hey, it's the month we got to have War Games. It's the month we got to have Hell in the Cell. You know, I prefer these things to be more organic. So I would traditionally you keep best of seven in the holster for, you know, they're few and far between because you need the right story and they got to mean something. So, Wade, your thoughts?
I like the idea of shaking it up because there's so many belts and to have a differentiation with them would be nice. I don't know if the team with the most wins makes sense because then you're just going to have teams just wanting to just have a ton of matches. Like storyline-wise, like, you know, someone who's around the whole year. I like the idea of having if you were to go that route, where you had, you know, and maybe you could do more than once a year, but where you would have a mini tournament, like the top four teams get selected, they wrestled over the course of a month, and then the winner gets the best of seven series. I like that more than just the person, the team with the best record. I am curious how they handle it, and if we get a Trails title match on every pay-per-view, because boy, does that tie up the Bucks and Kenny, you know, obviously just as long as they're champions, but it ties them up for a while. But in a way, that's also good because then it doesn't define down Kenny as a top single star. It just, he's busy doing something else important with it, with an important title with two wrestlers he has a history with. So then when they're not champs and they've gotten the rematch and they come up short or whatever it is, that's when Kenny can, in a friendly way, say, I've got other things I want to do now. And the Bucks could do the same thing. I don't know. I think there's a lot of ways you can play it, but I like Jay being creative.
Yeah, I think my guess is the if presuming they're going to the top flight in AR Fox as the next challengers, I would think by the pay-per-view they would be, if they're looking for new challengers, it might be the Spooky Knights of the Dark Roundtable. You know, who are in some weird feud where the numbers don't add up with Kingston and Ortiz. You would think they would be the next logical. They're also the team that you could see beating the Elite for the title, those six-man titles, but I don't know if they're ready to lose them that quickly.
All right. Cool. I think I've covered Jay's email. All right. So up next is Paige is pointing at a reunion with the Elite, not CM Punk. He said he was triggered by something she said earlier when she said Elite. Okay. So Patricia emailed and just said that the Hangman Page reference was likely the Elite. And obviously I was being a little cheeky when I said CM Punk. I don't know if Patricia realized that. But when she said Elite, then that is when he said he was triggered by something. So I guess if we watch it back, maybe that is the tell. And again, I'm not particularly fond of another Hangman Elite storyline. Maybe it's the way to set up a trios feud. But I don't know. I mean, we talked about that earlier. I'd like some fresh matchups and fresh dynamics and people leaving their bubble, their safety bubble.
Yeah, I will pop huge, and I hope they do it at a show in Chicago, the Elite reunion. But I don't feel like, in some ways, all of the groundwork in the world has been laid for it, in that they've been continuing the story off and on since AEW's inception. And then on the other hand, I still feel like they're all not in the best position now on the chessboard to do that and to have a reunion now where, you know, there'd have to be a bunch of turns. One turn in Paige's case, if they went heel, which is not the way to go, or you know, the Elite turning babyface, it doesn't seem like enough groundwork has been laid for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but maybe it's possible this is Paige's quest and journey for the year 2023, and we don't get the payoff for many, many months.
Yeah. I agree. It could go a number of directions. All right. JB in Detroit says, hi team, with the actions of Saraya and Toni Storm in attacking Willow Nightingale tonight, what do you make of the women's division? I imagine we can't have two heel women's factions dominating the division. Do we soon get a face turn for Hayter Britt and Rebel? Does Shida join Ruby and Willow, creating a face women's faction that would still be outnumbered 2-1? What are your thoughts? I just say the way to deal with this is a trios women's title, Eric. Don't you agree?
How dare you? Wait, hold on. Let me do the Todd Martin. Wade. Yeah, I don't think we need another belt. I think we covered this earlier on in the show. I think it's a setup for Thunder Rosa's triumphant return to the company, and she's going to side with the originals. The weird part is I'm not sure where the wild card is. Where do Britt and Jamie figure into this feud? Is this going to be the whole women's division taking sides? Because in that case, I think you only have three outsiders, right? And one of them right now is a face, but Ruby, but she can certainly turn. Yeah.
And if they added Sasha Mercedes, that'd be too much, even. You know, like it would be almost too many. I mean, obviously, you know, you'd take that over not having her if you're Tony Khan, if you can make, you know, work out a deal. But I don't know, maybe they're setting up for that. But boy, they need some strong homegrown talent to.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see how this plays out. It's a little too fast for my tastes, not fast enough probably for Tony Khan's tastes. But the fact that we're even talking about the women's division and curious about what happens next is a positive sign for AEW.
JB from Detroit says, with the debut of Kushida tonight and the impending debut of Willie Mack on Rampage this Friday, when is enough enough with the constant flow of one-off wrestlers? You get to the point of becoming numb to the new faces, and there is certainly diminishing returns. I mean, there's a lot of, hey, he's available, wouldn't it be cool if, this will be a good match type matchmaking that goes on. I don't think it's going to go away. Maybe there's just less of a chance. The longer AEW is around, the fewer chances there are to bring somebody in with a reputation they earned outside of AEW to have a match against somebody that Tony Khan is intrigued with, who's part of AEW. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, you know, when Kushida comes out and he's got the sunglasses and they're just speed talking through who he is, it's just it's not ideal. I think for holding and building an audience, obviously it super serves a significant chunk of AEW viewership. That's not in denial, but you know, it does feel a little bit sugar rush matchmaking.
I mean, look, while I might sympathize with JB's contention that this is, you know, the one-off wrestlers, when is enough enough? I don't know if you've watched AEW's 2019 when it launched, but it's kind of Tony Khan's go-to thing. In fact, it may be his number one go-to thing. And it's either – he's either doing people favors to help them get paid, some of it, like especially, you know, like during the pandemic. He's doing it because, hey, wouldn't this be a cool match to see? I have the money. I could fantasy book whatever the hell I want, and he does so. And some of it is to save you know, established roster guys from doing jobs, right? I think that's a side effect. I don't know if that's an intention, but you know, it's a way to bring cool matchups. You know, Tony Khan likes bringing in new people, and the one-off people coming in and losing, I guess I'm not over that. I mean, to me, maybe possibly the bigger problem is AEW keeps adding to their roster, and they haven't added any television hours, so they face the same dynamics, you know, locker room tensions probably that they did. There's only so many top slots to be pushed and to get a push on TV and get regular TV time, and there's way too many people for that. And that's, you know, he keeps adding people to the roster, you know, full-time in addition to all these one-offs.
And by the way, you know, like, if Jay White comes or he signs Kushida or Will Ospreay, like, it's less of a big deal to me if they showed up and did a job or showed up and had sort of a forgettable, isolated, you know, 1 or 2 week program. It's not like, whoa, I can't imagine what it would be like to see Jay White walk out onto an AEW show. Well, we got it, and it didn't mean anything, or it didn't mean much, and there wasn't follow-up. And so in a way, you're kind of taking away something. It's like, you know, being there for the wrapping of the gifts, you know, a week before Christmas. You know, like, it just takes some fun. Save these for when you sign them and you can really invest in them and introduce them to the entire audience and have it be more than a one-off match. Again, this is not the most egregious thing I've ever complained about in professional wrestling. We're getting good matches out of it. And it's not like they can't be useful and over and valuable contributors if they go full-time down the road because they showed up. But it just, ideally speaking, I think there's enough of a downside in the moment doing it, and it takes a little bit away from when they do show up. So, you know, I would do it less often and you know, pick my spots a little more. I'd be a little more discerning.
Yeah, I mean, I really have no desire to see any more than one match of Willie Mack and any more than one match of Kushida, who is so buried in New Japan after his, what do you have, like foot and mouth disease or some crazy, crazy affliction last year that he got, that New Japan hasn't even really figured much into New Japan's plans. He was in the junior tag league and that's about it. He was not one of the four people in the four-way junior match at Wrestle Kingdom. So it's like, I you know, he's available. Rocky Romero says use him. You can use him if you want, and they used him, and hopefully yeah, that'll be it. Although it was hilarious at the end. Did you notice Kushida held up his one finger, indicating he, and the announcer suggested it indicated he wanted one more match, and Darby was having no part of that. He's like, no, pretty much we're done. We did our one and done here. I gave you 90% of the match, as I, Darby Allin, always do in all of my matches, because I'm way better selling as the underdog babyface. Yeah, and he never did get the yes, I will give you a rematch nod from Darby. Instead, I noticed this. he went to raise Darby's hand and he grabbed the hand, the arm Darby was selling the whole match, the shoulder Darby was selling the whole match, and Darby wouldn't let him raise the hand, that arm. He instead had to switch to the other. So that was a really nice attention to detail at the end of, at the end of the show.
Very much, yeah. All right, and then JB, third point. Do you think that we'll get another crossover with TBS's impending season of Impractical Jokers coming next month? I can say this has not crossed my mind. Last year, we got Jericho on the show, and I heard a rumor that MJF did some filming from the show this season. All the guys from the show are from Long Island, and two of them are big-time wrestling fans. Is this a regular crossover between AEW and other Warner Discovery properties, a good sign for a future TV deal? As always, love the show, and go VIP. What do you think, Eric? I mean, it's fine to do it. No downside. But I don't know if it means, I don't know if it's a pot. It's not a negative sign for a TV deal, but I wouldn't read into it too much. I guess that'd be my reaction to that.
I would agree with you. And
Cody did them too. Cody did that too when he left, yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Different situation. But
you could not, I can't even imagine who they would have to get on Impractical Jokers for me to tune into such a show. But MJF, I would not watch. I'd catch the highlights on Twitter or YouTube, but I would not watch a full episode of that show. I guess we'll find out, as one of the highest rated shows on TBS that Warner Brothers Discovery has, how much that means to them when it comes to contract renewal time. If they only renew them at $44 million a year, reported to be the current deal, that is not a good sign. Well, anyway, actually, it just means the Cons will have to probably have to continue dipping into their family fortune a little bit to keep AEW afloat, although I think Tony Khan said they would be profitable already, not for the video game expenses. But opportunity cost in Economics 101, it's like, well, Tony Khan could be doing anything with his life, and this is what he wants to do. At some point, it becomes financially like, hey, we're making $3 million a year on this, and it's like, is it worth it for him to do? So I continue to be alarmed by the bloodletting going on at Warner Brothers Discovery, and just, they did this merger, and then the result is HBO Max is not as good as it used to be, and they're cutting all the scripted shows. I'm like, merging for the sake of what, right? I efficiencies. Well, you're still cutting $3 to $4 billion, $5 billion out of the company and making it all lesser. So I am not super optimistic, but I'm hoping AEW gets even a deal that's twice what they're currently getting, just under, maybe under $100 million. That would really help them as they're trying to re-sign a bunch of free agents in the coming years.
And just keep things, competitive.
Yeah.
I think the last thing that we haven't just kind of covered much is just the Orange Cassidy and Jay Lethal match with the shenanigans throughout with the heels who were banned from ringside showing up in the front row. And then Chuck and Trent just happened to be nearby, just in case that happened, ready to harass them at ringside also. And we had a popcorn about to be spilled over Jay Lethal's head, and the director cut away. Shame on him or her. But Cassidy ultimately won. This was – I mean, Orange Cassidy, there's some, frivolity and silliness with Orange's gimmick and the best friends in general. And certainly Jeff Jarrett has kind of brought, the gimmickry and the schmaltz and stuff. But for people who look to AEW to be an alternative to this kind of thing, I don't know how they would feel about enduring this. But I think the action was pretty good. But, the match felt secondary to all the shenanigans. So, Eric, I guess my question to you, is this amusing, harmless fun or stupid juvenile frivolity that hurts AEW?
Boy, did I hate this entire segment. Oh, my God. So you have the combination of Orange Cassidy and Best Friends and Danhausen, which I actually generally like in small doses. I don't have a problem with it. And then you combine that with the insanity that is Jeff Jarrett's booking of finishes and matches and putting that kind of stuff together. That is not a good combination, and that was totally in evidence. First of all, you start with an RIP Jay Briscoe, graphic at the start, So then maybe you go to Top Flight and Young Bucks should be the first segment, right? A great tag match as an homage where the Young Bucks are doing some of the Briscoes moves, wearing the armbands. Great, you know, nice, classy tribute. Even you can't really, you know, when you're dancing on that line of where they won't let you talk much about Jay Briscoe. Instead, we get this absolute mess of a segment where the entire thing is that the match is just, as you pointed out, the match is secondary to the shenanigans. And, you know, Jeff Jarrett and Sanjay Dutt, two of the most obnoxious people on AEW television. My notes say, I can't wait for the day Jeff Jarrett is off TV. I almost wish they let the Giant interfere or Jeff Jarrett interferes so Sanjay Dutt would be off TV and be fired. That would be great. You know,
I think he's in tight with a boss.
Yeah, he might be. They let Lethal hit his finisher, right, as some sort of cover, and Orange just rolled out of the ring. So that's Jay Lethal or Jeff Jarrett politicking, like, let's protect Jay in this match. The match itself wasn't great, like, you know, two and a half stars, replacement level type match. Who could really tell, though, because most of the camera was not pointed at the ring for that much of this match. The fact that they needed to go twist themselves into a pretzel and go to these elaborate lengths, explain why Jay Lethal didn't have the numbers advantage and didn't win, right? I mean, all of this was convoluted and overbooked, which is most of the Jeff Jarrett segments. I didn't care about any of it. I did wonder, and here's a discussion point. Stephen Regal was Lord William Regal was on a podcast where he apparently said, dropped the bomb that, I came in and I was hired for a different role, and that role, he didn't say what that role is, but you would assume it's administrative or training wrestlers or whatever it might be, helping in the notoriously understaffed AEW office. He didn't say what it was, but he's like, I never really got to do that. Instead, I was mostly an on-camera personality. So my question is, Jeff Jarrett was brought in to ostensibly work in the arena department, like helping them book more arenas and possibly house shows they've talked about. Is he not going to be able to do those duties because he's on camera, which nobody wants? Wade?
I don't think that stops Jarrett from helping with live event work by being on camera and still working out and trying to stay in ring shape. I think he can do both.
Okay.
Yeah.
You did not like the match. You liked the match, the segment.
I was probably more amusing, harmless fun for me. But I'm not ruling out that I wouldn't veto it as far as they went with it. And when I say harmless fun, the idea that Trent and Chuck just showed up, like they happened to be there when this unexpected thing happened with the heels. Like, I don't like that stuff. I just want things to be more plausible. So I don't know. I mean, it didn't offend me, but it felt a little out of place being that prominent on Dynamite as the opening match. I thought it was a little risky to start to lead with that.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear what Todd Martin on the Fix has to say about this segment this week, since he is a stickler for making things believable and credible above all else. Go VIP. You can hear that show that's usually recorded on Thursdays and released late Thursday. And I tend to listen to it on Friday while I'm on the train commuting to work.
Oh, cool.
One other point I wanted to make, I know there was some talk that AEW had a pretty decent walk-up and last-minute sales for their LA show last week, and there was some talk that, you know, hey, maybe things are turning around after, you know, 6 weeks of good TV shows. Maybe they're building momentum, you know, more focused, more, you know, to your point, you like it when they focus on a core group of guys they're promoting, and they've done that, I think, since they got past that goofy Regal stuff and writing him off. But I looked at WrestleTix on Twitter, and I didn't see a ton of evidence that the houses are getting for Dynamite are, you know, going great guns. Lexington, Kentucky, next week, 4,400 in the Rupp Arena, which is a huge basketball arena for, you know, Kentucky basketball. First time in the market, 4,400. There's going to be a lot of empty seats that they're going to have to cover up. Dayton, Ohio. I think it's the first time there. It might not be. 2,500, not great. El Paso on February 8th, 3,000. And then the following week, part of the West Texas swing, Laredo, 2,100. Those are not great. I think El Paso has ticked up a little. They might be doing ticket deals. Phoenix on February 22nd, 5,500, debut in Arizona. I guess that's good, right? It's better than what they've usually been doing. But San Francisco on March 1st at the Cow Palace, a great arena for AWA fans. I think Kurt Hennig might have a beef about how he was treated at the Cow Palace against Dick Bockwinkel. Anyway, 2,600, not great. Revolution's only 6,100 in a big arena, not sold out. And Sacramento the following week, only 2,800. So out of all of these upcoming shows, Phoenix on February 22nd at 5,500 is good. Winnipeg, 6,300 is good. And then on March 22nd, Kansas City at 1,300. Just embarrassing. So,
yeah.
And AEW has historically tended to do well when the tickets go on sale, right? There's a mad rush to get AEW tickets because they tend to sell, you know, would sell out in new places, and that's no longer the case. So I guess still some choppy waters ahead to get some decent Dynamite crowds in the coming weeks and months for AEW.
That was my concern early on with AEW is you know, are they able to have 52 cities a year that they can have a crowd that looks good on TV for, and you know, how are they gonna look major league year round? And, you know, part of that is making sure that the stars are there and, you know, honestly, building a reputation for having some dark matches would be a bad thing. Cause there's a lot of stars who don't work Dynamite every week. And, you know, MJF might have a very limited number of matches he wants to do on camera, but man, if you started saying MJF's going to be working, you know what I mean? WWE gets away with it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's pros and cons to MJF. He doesn't have to be MJF. But, like, if all of a sudden, like, you started getting a reputation for there's these matches you can only see, you know, handheld camera shots, and these people in the building got to see it live, and it wasn't a TV match, and you made them special, that could help with attendance instead of just, hey, pay to go to see something you can see free on TV.
But I think that would require booking a little bit further in advance maybe than AEW is currently capable of.
Yeah.
And you could film that for your, you know, potentially future streaming service that you might get at some point or content.
Yeah, yeah,
hours of
sure.
content you're building yep. for your library to sell to somebody like WWE did with Peacock. I wonder, you know, I guess you could just make them tag matches, right? Tony Khan notoriously stingy with his ladling out the singles top star singles matches. He wants to make you pay for them on pay-per-view, and I get that. But that's the that's kind of the thing you'd have to do to like make a dark match be something you'd want to see, right? What do you think? Tag match? You don't want to give away Kenny Omega and Hangman Page the rematch in a dark match, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, but it is about it's a situation where you want to create a reputation that you get to see top stars in person wrestle who maybe only had a talking segment on that show, and they're in the building, and it can help. You know, future ticket sales that you get to see something that you get to talk to people about that they don't get to see, or at least they don't get to see on Dynamite.
Yeah, I mean, I think like if you're going to buy tickets to Raw or SmackDown, you are totally buying it for the brand because you're not going to know what the card is until, you know, WWE. Sometimes you don't know what the card is until the day of. But for AEW, it's certainly true. You don't really know what the matches are until a week or 2 weeks at the most before those matches take place. So, and the AEW has seemed on their Twitter to be doing more localized promos lately to promote local ticket sales. I'm not sure how many local people in each market are on Twitter to see it. But that's certainly a positive. And if you could have them promoting a dark match that you're only going to get to see, to your point, if you come to the arena on such and such a date, that could sell some tickets as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anything else you want to add, Eric?
That is it.
Hey, we got, you know, a couple hours out of that show. I thought we might stay at about an hour in terms of length of the post show, but we got some good conversation out of out of this two-hour Dynamite, like I said, not quite as newsworthy as Adam Cole returning or the seventh match in a best of seven series and that kind of thing. But an enjoyable show, and they certainly gave us plenty to talk about, including a bigger dose of women than usual.
You mean the thing you referred to at the start of the show as the two-hour rampage? That Dynamite episode of Dynamite?
It wasn't as much of a dig as it would be for you. It just means Rampage is often matches presented without a lot of context. Not always the top stars in against top stars in some format. And this felt more like, a couple scripts for Rampage that got moved to a Wednesday.
Fair enough.
Cool. Eric, thank you so much. Everyone check out his article at pwtorch.com on how Tony Khan handled all the setbacks and inconveniences, some brought on, some of his fault, some not, some in his control, I guess, better way to put it, and probably most not. Cool. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will talk to you guys next time. Take care, Eric.
Take care.